Uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
I'm looking literally, I've still got access to the podcast back end, because I assume that'll be probably one of the last things that they get rid of for some reason.
The only person who lost email access so far is Tim, and it's because he sent them an email about how Bruce Dixon's dick doesn't work or something.
Tim, what? What was this?
I sent them a very rude email, and I posted it on Twitter that his memo had my dick doesn't work energy, and then my email got turned off, so I may have been fired. If I lose a week of pay over that without having been notified, I'm going to have my lawyer write a very nasty email and recover my money. So I think I said something rude, but I think I also said something true, and I will live.
Did you guys see Parker Molloy ran his letter through one of the AI detection services and it came back and back. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they're not like those AI detection services are not great. They're not perfect, but that would be very funny if he used ChatGPT to write his email. And it, you know, like reading it, it wasn't exactly.
It's not Shakespeare.
No, it's not Shakespeare, right? Beautiful. Do we want to go around the table and introduce ourselves real quick?
Yeah, Mac Lamoureux. I was a senior reporter on the extremism desk here. I've been here since October 2016. Started at Vice Canada, then Vice.com, and finally Vice News. So I've been all over this fucking website. 7 or 8 years I've been here now.
I'm Anna Merlin. I was a senior staff writer on the features desk when that existed. And then I was a senior staff writer at Motherboard. And then I was just sort of generally at Vice News, all covering the same thing. And I've been here since October 2019.
I was a features editor at Vice doing, like Anna, the same thing while being moved around into different buckets. And I started in summer of 2019.
That's an amazing question. So ostensibly, I was hired to be a senior social media editor at Motherboard, or at Vice generally. And then I think I was moved over to Motherboard or working with Motherboard. I don't really remember how that all started. Eventually, they promoted me to a manager position without giving me anybody to manage. And then they told me that I shouldn't be doing social anymore, so I would just be a regular editor. But that never panned out, except for job responsibilities. So I would just say I'm an editor at Vice, just to make it easy. Was.
I mean, I guess currently we still are.
Yeah,
at the moment that we record this, we are technically still employed.
It is Friday at 11 a.m., and currently I think we're all still employed.
Yeah, so just to set the scene here, Mac, we're going to have Mac on to talk about an incredible story that he had written. This wonderful, well, I won't say wonderful, this well-reported and important feature that he'd written. And then we all, you know, woke up. Realized that Google Takeout didn't work, and then rumors had come down that the site was getting deleted. We don't have access to the content management system in the back end, but I still have access to upload a podcast, so we're doing a rogue podcast going out the door to sit and bitch and reminisce about our time at Vice, and just say goodbye to cyber and to the site and to each other. So that is what we're here to do, and to kind of, I think, really explain what happened here, because it's not as if we didn't know that this was going to happen. We just kind of didn't know the exact timeline or the shape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've been living under the clouds of, like, a great bloodletting for years now.
Yeah. It wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when.
Still sucks.
Yeah, it's still awful.
I think, too, the reason why everybody immediately jumped yesterday when we started getting these tips, these rumors started going around about the site being deleted, is that at this point, really anything was possible. Mm-hmm. Like, the site being deleted, to be clear, would be like nonsensical. It would make no sense from a business perspective. It would make no sense from a legal perspective. Like, some of us have litigation holds on things related to stories that we did. Taking down the site would be a violation of a litigation hold. It would be really crazy, but the decisions that have been made at a management level have been so baffling that we were like, we don't know what they'll do.
When was the last time anyone talked to anybody in the C-suite? It's been like 6 months, right? There's been any kind of communication?
As far as I know, like even with Josh, from what I've heard through the grapevine, Josh Visser is the EIC of Vice News. He was frozen out of conversations in regards to a budget in the last few months. So even like our head of management have been frozen out of talking to the fucking babies in charge.
I knew something was wrong when Corey Hake stopped sending us a content snack emails. Corey is an executive who's honestly, I don't even know what her job title is anymore. Do you guys?
Girl boss.
Yes. And she used to send these little emails every Friday that were titled content snack. And it was, you know, clips from, I guess, the parts of the company that she considered useful or worthwhile. It was usually something on the TV side. It never really reflected anything on the writing side. And they were in these very like cute little upbeat tones. I believe we got a content snack like right after a round of layoffs.
We did, yeah.
one time at Vice Canada layoffs, because these have been happening since 2017, like yearly.
Of course.
We walked into the office in Toronto and they had just bought us like, I can only say like $250 McDonald's breakfast sandwiches and just laid them out on the desk in front of everybody. And like the smell was horrific and everyone was like, what the fuck is going on here? And then they just laid off a bunch of people and they're like, but do you guys want an Egg McMuffin? And I didn't get an Egg McMuffin this time, which sucks.
Well, that would require there to be like an office. Well, I guess there is an office to go to in New York City, right?
Yeah, but not in Canada anymore, right? There's no Toronto office.
No. They sold it to, I think, TikTok Canada during the pandemic. That office was fucked. It like had ghosts in it. Like not like real, but I mean like it used to host like 300 people in there. And then by the time we left, there was like 17 of us in this giant empty warehouse. And it just felt fucking haunted and I was pretty happy when we got rid of it.
So my belief about the New York office was that it was like literally cursed, not haunted, but cursed. Because as everybody knows, the Vice New York office used to be the home of a venue and, you know, which was very unceremoniously like shoved out to make way for Vice. It was Glasslands, right? I'm sorry, it's early here. My brain is not working yet. Was it 285 Kent?
Yeah, there's a great Jeff Rosenstock song about Vice cutting out the venue. I think it's called Wave Goodnight to Me. Wave Goodbye to Me.
Yeah, that sounds right. But so people were always injuring themselves in the office. Like, and I don't mean to make light of this, but this did happen. Sorry, it was both Death by Audio and Glasslands before it was our cursed office.
A storied history.
A storied history. And so people are always falling down the stairs. There were a lot of like injuries. There were weird, inexplicable cold spots. I mean, maybe people were falling down the stairs because they were going up and down these incredibly steep stairs, like with laptops and phones and like being, you know, demonstrating the lack of spatial awareness that journalists generally have. But like, I will say, like when you were in there, you're just like, oh, this is not a good place. This is not a place like touched by the light of the Lord.
This is not a place of honor.
I also just want to point out that it didn't. It had massive dead spots for both cell reception and meaning that you couldn't use the internet in basically the entire basement where there was a TV production facility. That's where like Vice News Tonight was put together. There were editing bays for that. And so you couldn't work in most of the basement unless you were hard plugged into the internet, which is always really fun. And then the entire rest of the office didn't really have places where you could take phone calls. And large parts of the office had bad music playing over loudspeakers. So it was yeah, not really possible to do parts of your job in the office, which is just one of those kind of telling things, I guess, along with the famous mystery of why there was so much milk.
The milk. Why the milk?
I'm happy to go both into the Wi-Fi thing and the milk. I would have to like make TikToks, which I would have to find an abandoned room somewhere in which to make the TikTok and always have a little droning noise in the background of the audio because it was not an office, despite being a TV and et cetera studio for making any sort of content. But anyway, you would have to walk up the stairs, two flights of stairs, and out to a porch and hold up your phone like it was 2007, up to the skies to get enough reception to be able to upload a TikTok. And it would take like 20 minutes out of my work day in which you can't close out of the TikTok app and you're just watching TikToks go by as the percentage is creeping up to upload. But the milk was very interesting. So when they reopened the office after, you know, lockdown, when there was like a whole push to return to office, we found that there was a lot of milk in the fridges at the office. They'd gotten rid of every other snack. You know, we used to have like chips and cereal and whatever. But now it was just like cartons and cartons and cartons of milk, both dairy milk and non-dairy milk. It was fascinating. Nobody knew where it came from or why it was there or why we had milk instead of, you know, equipment or anything that was actually.
I'm talking like a dairy case you would see in like a reasonably sized grocery store. Like
one, exactly.
Like, this is like there were 4 quarts of milk.
Would this be like restocked? Like, would they continuously have this amount of milk?
So, but I personally, and I wasn't in the office that much, but I never saw anyone restocking it, which was the other sort of creepy thing. Like, again, to go to my point, cursed, haunted, whatever, like, I never saw anyone restocking it, but there was always milk. There's also like a metaphor here, right? Because there is the snack barometer for media companies. You always know a media company is in trouble. The snacks start dwindling, they get worse, they go from being like name brand, whatever, to Kirkland, whatever. Then eventually there are no snacks. But in the case of Vice, always a baffling place, it wasn't that there were no snacks, it's that there was one thing that no one wanted that we kept pointing out, that we kept saying, like, how much is this costing?
Well, it was different kinds of milk, too.
Different kinds of milk.
It was like, they had the oat milk, they had the soy milk, they had, you know, it was very strange.
You guys had a milk bar.
Yes.
We literally did. I always thought about, like, should I take some home? You know, when I would be in New York, I'd be like, should I just take some for, you know, wherever I'm staying? But then it's like, you don't know the provenance of this milk. I don't know.
Unless it wasn't opened at that point, which many of them were not.
This could be illicit milk.
I always wanted oat, but I don't think they had that. I don't know. It was very strange. Did they have oat?
They had oat, for sure. They had oat.
Some of the thing, too, is like, I don't know about you guys, but in my early days of working in media, like when I was first at Gawker Media, like those snacks were quite literally like a large portion of my diet, you know?
I won't lie. The Canadian office never had snacks. We would sometimes get apples and we had a coffee machine. But like, as I said earlier, if snacks arrived, like that was a harbinger of bad times ahead. We would have a town hall and they would announce that one of our editors was going to jail because he was smuggling Coke to Australia. So like, whenever we saw snacks, it was bad news.
But you guys didn't need snacks because you have a social safety net as a country.
That's a good point. We do have health insurance. So
it really is true that you can like tell the digital media story in New York through snacks. I remember the first time I went to the Daily Beast office, as my friend was working there, and it looked like the bulk bin section of Whole Foods. It was another massive commercial operation, and it was all filled with like super sugary kid cereals and like all the Reese's peanut butter cups and M&Ms, like a really good snack bar. And I was a little bit freaked out because it was immediately obvious to me that the purpose was to keep underpaid 23-year-olds like just sitting at their laptops, pumping themselves full of sugar, like all you can eat. And it was a little bit disturbing. And I remember something pretty similar in one of the BuzzFeed offices when I visited them. Yeah, it's definitely. And then it changed because over the years, as unionization came in and the underpaid 23-year-olds became unionized 28-year-olds and all that, it seemed anecdotally, I couldn't quantify this, but it seemed like things tipped from having all the like Cocoa Puffs you can eat to, you know, prepackaged almonds and like bougie health food to keep the more sophisticated now writers chained at their laptops and not leaving the office for any reason.
Yeah, Special K became the cereal of choice, I think.
It's so strange. I remember the first time I ever encountered this was in San Francisco, actually, at the Medium offices. And I come from the retail world, kind of wormed my way into digital media. It was a very strange office because it was only a quarter filled, much like the Vice offices often. Very open, lots of empty desks, beautiful looking 25-year-old coders dressed like Banana Republic models, and just too much money spent in places that I didn't understand. Like, instead of a whiteboard outside of an office where you could write, like, I'm in a meeting or this, you know, section is blocked off for this amount of time, it was an iPad at every door. It's like, why would you spend that money to have an iPad at every single door just so you could say that you're in a meeting in there? It's very wild. It's an incredible amount of money. And obviously Medium hasn't, if anyone even remembers that publication, it has not fared well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I had one other funny Vice memory that I didn't even remember until just now. That's so funny. I completely repressed this. So before I actually came to work at Vice, like 2 years prior, they reached out to me for like a on-camera role, like whatever you call that, our beloved colleagues who...
Talent, you know, I think, right?
It's talent who stand in the field getting blown about by wind, talking about Syria or whatever. And I sat down with this HR person and I was like, oh, this lady has no idea who I am. Like, there's no reason why I was called for this job. Like, they just, I don't even know. This might have been literally just like a spam bot. Okay. Cool. I'm not going to work here. And then they were like, well, we need you to do a camera test. And I was like, what? And so what the camera test ended up being was making me go up 3 floors to where I would eventually sit when I started working at Vice, where all these journalists are sitting at their computers trying to work and making me deliver like on camera lines basically and like walk back and forth. So I'm doing this in front of a room of like, I don't know, 200 people trying to work. It's dead silent in there and it's just me talking and pacing back and forth. I wanted to fucking die.
I had to do those too. We called them desk kits and they were the fucking worst. And they would just like feed you lines and then you'd have to say them back. Meanwhile, like Manisha Krishna, who is my desk mate, would want to fucking slit my throat.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
Yeah, it does.
Why did it always felt like the broadcast side and the digital news side were just not communicating whatsoever. They were in the same space, like overlapping each other and getting into each other's way. And just not there, but it seemed like there was just no communication between the two sides. It was really odd to me.
Well, and also no communication within the sides because, you know, I'll leave this to Anna to describe. But I think one or the other of us, you know, mostly Anna, but sometimes me, were approached like literally 10 times by producers from various parts of Vice who were working on like basically the same conspiracy production, and none of whom appeared to have any familiarity with our work past, oh, those are the conspiracy guys, and none of whom appeared to be aware of the other one. So it's kind of like this incredible Galapagos Island thing where you get to see how ideas propagate without any external influence, and somehow they all came up with the exact same, like, not that interesting idea.
It was always, we are doing a piece about what is a conspiracy theory. It was always literally that. Like, that was the idea. And I'd be like, oh, well, I think so-and-so is working on this too. And then that would not really land for whatever reason. I also, this is sort of funny and sort of dark. There's somebody who is a person in the conspiracy world who's kind of left the conspiracy world. He's pretty infamous. He doesn't really talk about his time in the conspiracy world anymore. For whatever reason, he does talk to me, like, will just DM me. And so about every 6 weeks, he'd be like, hey, someone else from Vice is trying to get me to talk to them. Can you please, please ask them to leave me alone? Like, I want to leave this part of my life behind. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, man. I literally don't know who that is. And then it would happen again, like 6 weeks later. So this poor man who literally, like, lives in the woods now and has tried very hard to get away from the community that he was affiliated with and the time that he was affiliated with it, and it's been quite a long time, is just periodically getting hounded by Vice producers.
Well, not anymore.
No, I guess not.
He's finally free.
Yeah, he's finally free. I'll send him a message.
Our national nightmare is over.
You know, we're talking about it as if it has been shut down, but we don't actually know what was happening. The memo that was sent to us is now public. Everyone can read it for themselves. And it's so
vague.
Well, there was an email that was sent to, like, the digital teams that none of us were privy to. Have you guys been sent that?
No. I saw it, yeah. Okay, so the TLDR is basically, I don't know who the message is from, but it applies to the digital side of things. And by digital, I don't mean necessarily the culture side. I mean, like, kind of R29, kind of the weird
socials?
In-between. Yeah, well, no, not news socials.
Oh, really? Yep. I thought this was to news socials, too.
No, we obtained it.
Oh, hell yeah. Good job.
Look at you.
Wasn't me. I woke up to a bunch of text messages. I will not take any credit for this. But yeah, so basically it's the email not only includes description of someone including a Little Women reference in a speech
Pretty Woman.
Pretty Women, excuse me, not... I was hoping it was Little Women. I don't know why. Maybe it would be from Beth's death or something. That would be apt. But yeah, basically saying Vice is still going to function, which is very funny to me. Let me actually pull this up so I'm not just speaking.
Yeah, I would love to see this.
There was the reference to, like, pivoting to social channels. Like, sorry, I know this will sound very disorganized to listeners, but we are just quite literally trying to drill down through the layers of weird HR and executive speak to understand, like, what the fuck they're talking about and what this could possibly mean.
Well, I think it might be helpful to maybe go through the timeline of what happened over the past, do you think 24 hours would be accurate, or should we do some scene dressing first?
Yeah. I think maybe even the past year.
Yeah.
So what I would suggest is we do a 4-1-2-3-5 structure where we start in the middle of the action and then we go back to, you know, to the beginning so that the audience is invested by the time we get to, you know, 3, the history section where it usually drags a little bit. Oh yeah, I'll teach this shit, guys.
Yeah, just short, punchy lead.
Anybody wants to hit me up, I'll teach you how to write a feature about losing your job.
To understand Vice, you must understand the media industry.
I'm going
to
do the invention of the, you know, like the printed book and, like, you know, the written word and the Gutenberg Bible. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, a year ago. What happened a year ago? Who wants to start with that?
Tim's the angriest.
Yeah, Tim.
I don't know that I'm the angriest. I think... I'm a very chill person.
You're the most impassioned.
I don't know. About a year ago, the company went bankrupt. Like, do we want to start there?
Yeah, I think we should start there.
And since 2017, almost every year, and in some years, every quarter, we've been faced with layoffs. The scale of these layoffs would change. Sometimes it'd be like, you know, 6-7 members of the team. Sometimes it would be closer to like 20. But there was never a year where we were safe for layoffs. It was usually once or twice. I got used to like one really big one happening in the summer and then one kind of smaller one happening at the end of the year was kind of how I looked at it. And all this kind of led up into the company declaring bankruptcy. Maybe I'll toss this lateral to Tim here.
Yeah, they did that. And before that, they had just stopped paying vendors. We would have various newsroom tools shut off and nobody would tell us anything. And, you know, the bankruptcy didn't come out of nowhere. But I think one of the things that was baffling about it to me was that I joined as part of a big reorganization. And then every time there was a round of layoffs, there would be a completely inscrutable new strategy and department shuffling and you know, lines of business being consolidated, all of which were, it was really hard to tell what was going on because the actual like nouns they would use didn't really have any relation to what was going on. So like the digital team was completely separate from the team that created digital content that went on the internet. Like it was not the same thing, not reporting to the same people. And there was no real, there was no real talk there, which is just to say that in, it was really increasingly hard leading up to, you know, filing for bankruptcy protection to even tell who was in charge of what or what different parts of the company did, because there were so many layers of bureaucratic reshuffling that had gone on and built on top of each other that it was just completely impenetrable. You couldn't tell any, like pretty much anything about what was happening outside of your own area of the company that you had visibility into. And then talking to people at other parts of the company, they expressed the same. They were like, oh, so you work in, you know, this part of the company, like who's, you know, who's in charge of that? And they just had no real idea. So yeah, that doesn't really answer. The bankruptcy is something I don't personally want to talk about just in any detail, just because
it's also kind of boring.
Things wrong there. It's kind of boring. I mean, basically, yeah, they, you know, there wasn't enough money coming in and there was a lot of money being spent. Some of it on pretty ridiculous things.
And we kept having changes in leadership all the time. And I don't really mean this in C-suite because, you know, frankly, they can go fuck themselves. But like we had like Matthew Champion, we had Michael Learmonth, our last EIC, Josh Visser, like a good friend of mine at on Motherboard. You guys had everybody depart for 404. So the last year has just been like an incredible, it almost feels like a bit of a fever dream through work. We were just kind of told to like grin down and bear it and try to produce the best work we could in the circumstances. I feel a lot of us did produce very good work. I mean, this week I put out a fucking 6,300 word story on a sextortion ring that like involved me dealing with like children being self-harmed, and then they fucking lay me off in the same week, which I'm very stoked on. But like I feel under the circumstances, a lot of us put out very, very good work. But the last year hasn't been fun.
Yeah, I mean, Tim and I spent the last year writing about Operation Underground Railroad and its founder, Tim Ballard, and, you know, unraveling these layers and layers of things that were not true in how Ballard and OUR represented their work and Ballard's biography. And we did this, you know, like not to be immodest, but with no resources. We didn't have LexisNexis. Like we didn't have most like access to any kind of like subscriptions. The software that we used to use to like transcribe interviews didn't work anymore. You know, like we just did this with nothing but ourselves.
I've been paying Pacer out of my own pocket for my last investigation.
Yeah, I pay for Pacer and I pay for Tape a Call. This is a fun pro tip. Tape a Call, you can add on a transcription, like subscription to Tape a Call.
Oh, is it good?
Which it's fine. I mean, I don't think any of them are good. So I used to transcribe tapes for a living when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. And so I'm very like alert to the things that machines always get wrong, but it is not bad as a place to start, and then you go clean it up. So yeah, you heard it here first, everyone. You can use Tape a Call to tape your interviews, and you can use their transcription service to not have to transcribe everything yourself.
Yeah, I think it was also really fun when Getty Images would just randomly shut off, which means we had to pull lead images for stories that, you know, were not incriminating or misleading out of thin air. So that was fun.
I actually just had that because I ran a story earlier this week and I couldn't get Getty to work. It's foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we, like, you know, as we said at the beginning, like the last year has been so bizarre. People have left and have not been replaced. But I think the important thing too here is that Vice was, you know, went bankrupt, filed for bankruptcy protection, and then was bought out of bankruptcy immediately by, you know, Fortress. And there were two others. There was Fortress. There was like a minority stake from George Soros's fund to save journalism, whatever that is. And I, at that point, was like unwise enough to be a little bit optimistic. You know, yeah, it was Fortress, Soros Fund Management, and Monroe Capital. And I was like, okay, well, this is a consortium of, you know, our former lenders, and surely they have some kind of motivation to keep it going, which was silly.
As an aside, I'm so stoked that it's George Soros that's finally putting the knife into us. Like, I find that very funny.
Yeah. I guess we weren't working for him after all. You know, I'm sure Mac, you get this too. If you write about conspiracy theories, you're constantly being told you're being paid by George Soros, and I can be like, well, you know, he didn't save me now.
All those weirdos in my emails are in for a shock.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing with the milk too. I kept joking. I was like, damn, all those people calling us soy boys were right. We are funded by Big Milk.
It's so like the milk thing is so grim because there was so much stuff that wasn't getting paid for, like Pacer and Getty, and yet all that money towards milk.
Maybe we were secretly a project of the dairy industry and it had gone on long enough and they decided to just shut us down.
Corey Hake is pivoting to milk.
No, I'm not even gonna go there. I thought about it.
I think one of the recent signs for me that we were in deep trouble was it last week that we got the email touting the new CMS, but it's for socials.
Yeah, I can speak about that a little bit if you want to go on a little adventure over what happens to even the social people that are theoretically, I don't know. I feel like in a lot of places there is this manufactured us versus them at media companies between the people that do social journalism and the writers that do written journalism. And it always ends up, to me, being a very silly conversation because it's one and the same. You know, the social teams rely on the dogged work of writers and editors to, you know, do the reporting, to find these stories most of the time. And then the writers and editors rely on the social journalists to get their content out in front of readers in, you know, different audiences and in different ways, transformative ways. But there's this thought that, you know, TikTok being so big, and before that we had Instagram, Facebook. I was working on a number of Facebook Live shows in 2017 when I was first interning at Gawker Media. Yeah, at that time, I think it had finally become Gizmodo Media. To circle back to something we were saying earlier, I think I was shuffled under three or four different department heads in my first 2 years at Vice, because they continued to not know where to put social, if it belonged in its own department or belonged under editorial, which I believe it does. But at the same time, they would not give the resources towards social journalism in the way that they might give towards things that are much more easily turned into brand deals. Because you're not going to want a sponsored TikTok or Instagram reel when it's talking about, I don't know, conspiracies or something involving the Ukraine war, involving Gaza. But they definitely will want to sponsor, hey, here's me getting my hair done. Or, hey, do you want to go down the street and talk to this person about what they're doing to save money on car insurance? Not saying that some of the culture stuff isn't good, because it is. But it's always just been interesting about the way that Vice has wanted to invest in socials only when it is very easily mistaken for sponsored content, and not when it is meant as a vehicle for getting the reporting out there.
Yeah, and also not reckoning with the fact that as you're pointing out, like, it is very difficult to funnel some kinds of reporting through social media because social media companies flag any discussion of certain topics, even if it is like a journalistic discussion, even if it is news.
I think we got flagged so many times for various stories where we would discuss that conspiracy theories are false because we were discussing conspiracy theories. We had so many things that would get flagged and we couldn't do anything about it. They would hit, you know, millions of views and then get taken down because we didn't, you know, try to obfuscate the word drugs as DR asterisk, like GS or SEGS. I used to joke with people that my bosses at whatever job I was at were not my bosses. It was the people that were in charge of turning the advertising money and the algorithm on and off at these social media companies. And it's just always interesting to see a lot of, you know, talk at this place that we're in with journalism, with media writ large, as an us versus them kind of a fight.
Well, I think it's something that I've been noticing a lot in the past year. It's like I watch a lot of YouTube and I read a lot about conflict. And I am increasingly finding that the people that are really good about reporting on wars and conflict and do that kind of journalism outside of the major players have a really hard time existing in social media spaces for those exact reasons, because they're talking about things and sharing images and video of things that are not advertiser friendly. And so they get turned off, basically. Like, I see this happen to Jake Hanrahan at Popular Front all the time. He's in very weird places that no one else is going, reporting on things that other people are not talking about. And he can't really be on Instagram or Facebook or TikTok because the social accounts get turned off for the exact reason you're talking about. And it's really fascinating to watch, as part of this digital media story, kind of coming back around to sanitized broadcast news, basically.
Yeah, it's, and one of the fascinating paradoxes here for me is that, so for instance, I edited, Mac's story that he did on the Sextortion Cults, which is absolutely worth anyone who hasn't reading it looking it up. It's really terrible, and it's something people should know more about because it's something that sounds like it's something that almost sounds like a wild panic thing out of a chain email that kids are blackmailing other kids into self-harm or, you know, other horrible things. But it's true, and you know, it's demonstrated fact. Law enforcement agencies are very concerned about it. They're trying to find out more, et cetera, et cetera. So in the normal course of things, if we were just trying to present our journalism in as wide-ranging way as possible and reach people where they are, it would have made sense as part of the rollout of that to have done like a video for TikTok or a series of videos for TikTok laying this out. There are some people who aren't going to read a 6,000 word story, but we can still, you know, present the journalism in a different format. I think that's great. I have no problem doing that. But we didn't even consider it because you wouldn't even consider putting something that deals with these topics on TikTok because it would just get flagged and you would ding your account. At the same time that's happening, the internet is absolutely being overrun with child sexual abuse material, with non-consensual, in some cases fake, in some cases not, material involving celebrities. Like, this is all over Twitter, which is, along with Telegram and Discord, one of the primary places for the stuff to get distributed as Matt gets into his story. So the arbitrary algorithms have made it very difficult to distribute critical journalism on these topics while making it very easy to distribute like fake porn videos of Taylor Swift or child sexual abuse material. And it's, you know, I don't know what the solution there is. I don't think anybody knows what the solution is, but you have to think it involves some kind of regulation because, Yeah, you're really getting the worst of both worlds. And you know, I don't know what effective regulation looks like. A lot of people have thought about it, and there's not really a super neat solution. But you know, left to its own devices, this is where we're at.
I have no elegant segue from that. I'll bring it back around to this to get us back into kind of the Vice story. Emily, can you explain to me this email that we got? Was it last week or the week before, kind of announcing a pivot to socials, essentially?
Yeah, sorry. I know that I had started talking about that a little bit and then got sidetracked thinking of all the things that made me angry while working here. A very truncated list. I could go on. But yeah, so we got, it wasn't specifically an email about pivoting to socials, but something that Vice had done, this is many executives ago, had built this thing called Story Studio, which on its face, really good. Basically, it is a template system that allows a graphic design noob like myself to be able to basically stick any article URL into this software, and then it generates, using the Vice in-house style for images, for font, etc., a bunch of different options for what you could put on Instagram or otherwise. It was really great for people who are social editors or doing social that don't have the strongest background in graphic design, which, again, myself and many others that I know. So that was really great. But recently, there was a new email about this Story Studio software that basically made it seem like that was the thing that they were going to be investing all of their time and money into versus any of the other work done at Vice. It basically made it seem it made it seem that they were just going to go all in on socials and disinvest from everything else more than they already had been.
And this is at a time when our content management system is horrendous.
Has there ever been a time where it hasn't been horrendous?
It's gotten worse, though, because it's like degrading and there's bugs that are not getting fixed, right? Like the big one that we were dealing with when we were doing scraping is that if you're listed as an editor on an article, it puts that on your landing page. It didn't used to be that way.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, in addition to scraping everybody's written articles, it's also scraping everything they've ever edited. And there's kind of not, there's not a great, easy technical solution for that problem. When you're scraping, I'm not going to get into code shit on this Zoom call.
I think we could talk about that later about, you know, what it means to archive and what it means for things to exist on the internet in kind of, you know, this fleeting way.
Mm-hmm. I want to go on a short tangent here just because the CMS, this is a very Vice thing. CMS wasn't only like clunky and bad to use and wouldn't accept high resolution images, so that to put a header image on a story, you had to screen capture it a lot of the time and then upload your screen cap instead of the actual high resolution image. But as I pointed out about 5,000 times, not that anyone cared, it presented severe legal liabilities because for a long time, it wouldn't necessarily accept changes, or it would garble text if change went up after a story was published, which most of the time that's going to be for either, you know, minor typos caught after publication, which fine, whatever, or it's going to be for a correction. And so I remember writing these memos that were like, you know, I told legal about it and they were apoplectic. They just hadn't understood this. And I remember writing these memos that were like using very short words and explaining why if we can't control what actually appears on the website in the story, that exposes us to legal liability. For instance, if I publish something about someone and it turns out not to be true, I need to correct that. If I can't correct it, they have a much stronger case for defamation, because Vice has been made aware that something is wrong and has not promptly remove the incorrect information. So it's just this matter. So it's just this matter of trying to explain to people, you know, this is like morally and ethically a problem, but it's also financially a problem, because if the CMS barfs up, you know, Emily Lipstein is a murderer and we have images of her murdering, and she tells us, no, that's not true, and we can't do anything about it, that's really bad. And eventually it got a little bit more stable, but it was always kind of remarkable to me that nobody I talked to about it really seemed too concerned with the fact that, like, inadequate coding could be setting the company up to get sued through really, you know, no fault of the journalist or the legal department.
Yeah, this was something we raised many times, is like, the changes have to stick. Like, I can't redo and frantically resave stuff over and over and over, even if it's just to fix a typo. It doesn't look good to have a typo, you know, in the headline that's up for 5 minutes after publishing. I don't know. It's almost like we took our jobs really seriously. Maybe we shouldn't have.
Yeah, I tried way too hard. I really should have just been doing wage theft for like 7 years.
I mean, ironically, I didn't have time to look for a new job because I was so busy working.
I mean, it doesn't sound like it's going to happen now. And I know we've been like frantically archiving things, and it sounds like they might be keeping the website up. But I guess if you're listening and you weren't kind of following along, one of the things that was a big worry was that they were going to pull the entire website down. And to kind of have like a good chunk of your life, like that's where your work is. Like, I've written over 1,200 stories. Are any of them good? Only a few. Like, most of them are pretty shitty. But like, to have that just wiped off is such a fucking terrible threat and like feeling. I know that like we have the PDFs, thank to, I don't know if we want to get into it, but thanks to some wonderful people who helped us out. But just like to lose that, I don't know. I don't know if I have an eloquent point other than just like that sucked. Like, I really didn't love that feeling.
I don't think media companies generally take very seriously their obligations of stewardship, but I do think they have an obligation of stewardship, even if it's just to say we can't fulfill this obligation, so we want to hand the material over to a library. Journalists can get pretty insufferable about the importance of their work. And, you know, most of the stories I've written in my career have been, you know, they've been pretty ephemeral, but not all of them have been. And there's stuff that this company has published that has been responsible for, like, laws being changed, people being put in jail, people being held accountable for serious wrongdoing. And, you know, it's just part of the historical record. It's something that should be there in case people need to consult it, because, you know, it's not the case that people are going to be going back and reading old investigative stories about, you know, neo-Nazis from 5 years ago all the time. They probably aren't. But if somebody really needs that information, they probably need it for a pretty good reason. And so it's something, this is something that I do think has a pretty, you know, it has a pretty easy solution, but it requires people doing the right things when the archives of these sites are commoditized and they're treated as an engine to assure like a fairly good Google ranking that you can then manipulate to bring in revenue through putting up AI written product reviews and things like that. It should be possible for someone somewhere in the chain of ownership to realize that these stories and videos and other things that they own have, you know, they do have some minor historical significance, and they should be preserved in some format that will allow people to find them. And again, the way to do that is to work with professional archivists or a library. There are many such institutions in America. Not all of them are, you know, would be jumping up and down at the idea of preserving and maintaining a big unwieldy archive like the Vice archive or the Gawker archive, but you know, it should be possible to find someone who wants to do that. And so the fact that the idea instantly goes to, well, you know, we're pivoting the concept for the company, so let's just get rid of this so we can do something else with the website, as opposed to, well, you know, we don't want this, so let's give it to somebody who'll know what to do with it. It's just like crazy to me. It's just crazy. And there's no real explanation for it other than that, you know, the people in charge of these companies are just, you know, they don't really care and they don't really think about these things, which is, you know, kind of a funny thing. You know, there are all sorts of things I don't care about and I don't get in the business of overseeing and being responsible for them.
I think the phrasing that at least I've heard people use before is that we're losing recipes. Mm. And that feels very apt for two reasons, because, you know, recently I was interested in making Japanese curry and I remember that there was a Kotaku blog that was someone showing how to make literally the recipe for Japanese curry. The only issue is that all of the photos were taken off because there was some worry that I don't remember exactly what the deal was, but basically all of the photos and images on articles across the, you know, former Gawker network were wiped before a certain year, I think because of issues of, you know, legal obtaining of these photos or having licensing, et cetera, et cetera. These were images, and so they just decided, instead of going through and figuring out, okay, which are these images that we don't have license for, they just decided to wipe everything. Even images that were taken by or made by people on staff. So there's the Japanese curry recipe that doesn't work anymore because you have no clue what's going on. And then, Tim, I was looking for your dishwasher chicken video article today.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, it doesn't hit the same without these grotesque images of someone trying to make chicken in their dishwasher.
I keep most of my photos, so I can probably text those.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But, yeah, we're literally losing recipes.
The photo thing happened to Vice, too, right? Something similar, yeah. Everything before 2016.
When we switched CMS, not to get back to the CMS, when we switched CMS, the new one deleted all of the images. And I remember when this happened, it was probably around, like, I don't know, 2018. My editor at the time, Josh, actually came up to me. He was like, look, man, I'm not happy about what's going to happen, but you need to pick like 10 articles that we can keep the photos on. And then the rest, they're going to get wiped. And so I pick like my favorite articles from when either I was a freelancer or like in my first couple of years with the company. And then the rest, the photos went by, which, you know, like I'm a photojournalist as well. So a lot of those I took, and it's like almost as a resume, but yeah. Whee!
And this whole thing to me feels very motherboard and very cyber and an apropos thing to talk about in our goodbye, because it goes to a basic question of technology. And I think because of the way certain tech firms and tech evangelists have used the word over years, you know, the word technology brings to mind for me like racks of servers, robots, code, people strapping things to their faces so they can look at 3D porn, brain implants, whatever, you know, like world of the future science fiction stuff. But technology is just altering the physical world in a way that you find useful. And one thing we're seeing right now is that like the book, and to a lesser extent, the magazine and the newspaper are really unimprovable technologies because they're fixed. They're pretty permanent. You know, you can still read scrolls from thousands of years ago if you're careful with them. They don't, you know, if you don't set them on fire and you don't have moths eat them, they last. And they're not susceptible to these problems that people really weren't thinking about 10, 15, 20 years ago of, oh, you have this actually really important story that's largely built around videos and social media embeds. Is it even legible if someone just decides to wipe those? This is really unstable technology. And it's one thing I've increasingly been thinking about in recent years is making sure that as much as you want to package like, you know, a major investigation or a feature with as much material as possible for readers, it's really important to keep things to the text, like a print magazine story, as much as possible, because you have to think about
you know, what's this going to look like in 5 years if all the photos get stripped because of some clearance issue, or, you know, whatever. And that's a really weird thing to think about, that for all this, you know, world changing information technology that has come about in the last few decades, we're really at a point where if you have something really important to write about, it's probably best to get it in some sort of physical text format. That's what's going to make it last. The illusion that, you know, the illusion that the internet is forever was really tempting, but I think it's really important for people to not have any illusions about that. It's not.
It's incredible how temporary it's become and how fast silicon degrades compared to paper.
Yeah, we don't even, you know, I don't even think anybody really has any idea how much stuff is just going up and how much stuff is just going up in smoke. And it's, you know, it's a depressing thing to think about.
I don't think we have any of our Twitch streams.
No, I think that's all gone.
For listeners of this podcast, you may remember when this was recorded on Twitch. We do.
Yeah, this used to be broadcast live. It used to be a whole production involving several people pushing buttons, and that's gone.
Yeah, guess who edits this now?
Yeah, hopefully this goes out.
Oh, I've still got, it's going out.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's still going out. I've been obsessively refreshing that piece, and I've, just do a double check again. Still have access.
It would be extremely funny if the last thing we did for Vice was making a podcast that we ultimately could not upload. I will
say. Yeah, that would be the fucking most apt ending. If just like,
I will say, yeah.
And it's not because we were locked out or anything. It's just because our content management system wouldn't fucking let us upload it.
Well, luckily, the content management system for the podcasts is divorced from... It's not run by the company. It's a different back end.
I felt absolutely no emotion in going to the CMS homepage for our written articles and realizing I could not log in anymore. Like, there are many things about Vice coming to an end and no longer working here that I do feel a lot about that I'm sorting through. But, like, good riddance to that CMS, literally the worst CMS of all time. Like, looking at it and seeing, like, the API is unavailable, you can't log in, I'm just like, okay, you know, silver linings.
Yeah, we're free.
Not a lot of emotions, too, but I think my main one is, you know, my main one, aside from concern for all my colleagues and comrades in, you know, securing new livelihoods, is actually probably... happiness in a weird way. Not that, you know, this bad thing is happening, but the very chaos and lack of control that we're talking about, it's really telling and heartening to me that in a situation where there would have been every reason to, you know, not really do anything and just kind of sit around, not doing things, people have done really excellent work, like work that really matters up until the very last bit. And that fills me with hope for the future. The idea that if you, you know, pay people enough to pay their rent and eat and hopefully put a little bit aside and tell them to, you know, give them a very vague directive to like find things out and put it on the internet, they will find out interesting things and put it on the internet in a way people do want to read, and they can have some good effects in the world. That's, yeah, that's pretty cool and telling about our line of work, and makes me hopeful that we will find ways to continue to do it. Like this whole illusion that people aren't interested in news, and that, you know, the basic desire to find out what's happening in your community or around the world is an atavism that tech platforms can choke off because it can in some circumstances lead to people getting irate at them. Like, all that's passing, and I don't mean to just wave my hands and say it'll be figured out, but, you know, it will be figured out. It's a very deep-seated human need, and people will be people will be doing it one way or the other. And they do it even when the people who came to do it seem to be very hostile to them doing it. As I think, you know, the people working at this company have proven.
That's the thing about Vice is, for all of its faults, and holy shit, are there a lot. It was an incredible venue for talent. Like it was able to identify talent very well. Some of the people that I've worked with here are fucking incredible. Like some of the most talented, impressive people. And I was never not just taken aback by the work that they were able to do across a wide breadth of subjects. A lot of my favorite writers came through these doors. A lot of my favorite journalists. Like Anna, you're like one of my favorite journalists working today.
Oh God. Likewise, buddy.
Thanks, bud. And like, it's been a fucking shitty 7.5 or how many years I've been here, but I'd do it again, I guess. You guys are good.
Yeah. I don't know. Would I do it again? Yeah, I guess I would do it again. The stuff that we've been able to do, the fun we've been able to have, and also, frankly, just realizing that even as they strip away resources, we can still do it. You know what I mean? Like, none of this had anything to do with what the company was able to provide to us, short of, you know, the audience that Vice had built up. Like, everything else we did ourselves. Like, it was this group of people working with each other and looking out for each other, and, you know, and that's beautiful. Maybe we should start some sort of commune cult situation.
I'm
intentional
down.
Community. Oh man, Emily has a lot of interest in our cult commune, radical Christian elements. I will talk to you later about Cornerstone Magazine, which was published for years by the Jesus People USA, who are like a intentional community in Chicago, but they did publish a lot of investigation. That's the thing. They started out making this weird zine about Jesus, and they ended up doing like an expose over a guy who claimed to be an ex-warlock who was circulating on the Christian circuit. So, you know, I'm just saying.
Oh, I know that guy.
Yeah, dude. Mike Warnicki.
Yeah.
And you know about it because of Jesus People USA. Went from making the zine about Jesus to being like, this guy's full of shit.
Yeah, some personal news.
I think that's a nice, hopeful place to end on. It's unless Great. Somebody has something else. It's been an honor to work with all of you. It's been absolutely incredible. I've been very lucky and privileged to be here in the same room with all of you, even digitally.
Yeah.
Likewise.
I feel the same way.
All right.
It's been great. We
did some good stuff. Didn't we?
We did some incredible stuff.
I think so.
Just absolutely incredible things. And like you said, so much of it happened even in the last few weeks, there was incredible journalism coming out of Vice. We would have done years more of it. If, you know, the C-suite had pulled their head out of their ass.
Like, I want the listeners to know, like, how much Tim and I were losing our minds trying to get this investigation out in the last week. Mm-hmm. Like, fucking ripping our hair out. But we got it done.
You got it done. And it was tough on you. It was tough on you guys emotionally. And you did it. You did it in the midst of, like, obvious signs of doom and immense pressure. And you should be incredibly proud.
Yeah.
I think we all should, you know? We did good.
We did.
We did good.
And we will do more in the future.
Yeah. None of us, unfortunately, for the haters, nobody's going away. Just in a different form.
I wish.
I might go into the woods for a little while.
That sounds, yeah, I'm supposed to go on vacation next week. the end of next week, I'm going to Vermont. No, I'm literally, I'm very curious on if I'm going to get laid off in a gas station on Monday. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what the phone call is like when it finally comes.
Oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be so sensitive. They're going to do a really good job.
It's going to be like a YouTuber apology, but a mass layoff.
I wish.
I'm going to hear from a lady that I've never heard from before, you know, with an inscrutable job title telling me that there has been a redundancy and, you know, regrettably, I'm going to be beheaded immediately. So, you know, I can't wait.
HR, don't listen to this, but I actually put my notice in recently and I'll be starting a new job next week. I'm really kind of pulling for being laid off and getting severance because nobody knows.
That would be the kind of thing that would happen here. For sure.
Guys, I'm in Canada and it's a whole different legal process to lay me off and going through a whole different union that I believe at this point is just me and another person is our entire union in Canada.
Oh,
and
yeah, I'm texting with them right now.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a non-zero chance I just end up like the Office Space guy.